All right, we'll call the order, the Town of Curie Beach's Historical Preservation Commission regular meeting for Wednesday, January 6th. It was originally scheduled to start at 6 p.m., however, it is now about 6:25 because of the extension of our special meeting regarding the design guidelines. So this is a regular meeting. Is there a motion to adopt the agenda?
Make a motion to adopt the agenda.
Is there a second?
Second motion.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, next item is adoption of the minutes from our December 2nd, 2020 meeting. So let's go ahead and just take a minute and look through and see if there's any recommended changes. Before we get on to public comment, let me just add that I did do a presentation, a formal presentation to the town council meeting in December. It was a formal presentation regarding the update of where we were, so you know, talking about exactly, again, reminding, very similar to the update I did for our special meeting right there. Talk about positive impacts, talk about you know, the process, where we were, the Sawyer study, procedure, that the designation report had been submitted and that we were going to have a special meeting today, as well as possibly a discussion and a vote regarding the various aspects. So with that, we're in the public comment section of the regular meeting. Do we have anybody online who would like to have public comments on our regular meeting, where we'll be talking certainly about the continued discussion of design standards and some of the issues that have been raised in public meetings? So if there's anybody who would like to comment, please press star 6. Okay, hearing none. We'll close the public comment portion of this meeting and go to item number 5, which is old business, which is continued discussion of the design standards. And again, we'll turn this over to Mr. Eldridge to get started on this discussion.
Man, did you just set a microphone for the one hanging up?
Yeah, but it's better if you can talk into that.
Can I move this thing?
Yes, you can. Just take my wiggy. It's not locked. You can roll it.
Do you all have this on your screens?
We have it in front of us.
Because what I'm going to do is refer to the left-hand column. It's easier for me just to walk through the comments in my response.
Can we turn that one on? Or?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if you... Do you all have screens in front of you?
No.
Oh, but you had... I guess that's... I'm going to read them so you won't miss anything.
Yeah, I think you can grab it and make it a little bit bigger, can't you? The column. Is there an ability to grab it?
Yeah, she did. Maybe not. Yep,
there
you go. You can make it even bigger because I'm not going to refer to the document. Well, I guess I am in a way.
Okay, well, I can shrink the document a little bit.
And you can shrink the problem. Yeah, good. So if you go, I think one more page of page 3.
Oh, perfect. Where do you want me to go? Page
3
1?
Page 3.
Page 3? All right, well, it's thinking.
Mr. Owens, do you want to address some of the comments you have up there, or do you want to hear comments from the commission first?
Chairman, just a second, please.
Sure.
And Mandy, am I actually page 4? chairman, it's your commission, whatever you want to do. Yeah, that might be good to start that way.
Yeah, go ahead. The, you know, I basically have two comments after reading this. Again, I certainly do appreciate your effort of putting together this from where we were into a legal type of document here. And certainly, I think with, and I think you've already mentioned this, the section on
the extension of the non-residential use?
Yeah, the extension of, which one is that?
4.3.
For 4.3? In my opinion, I don't think we should allow an extension from a single-family resident to a multi-family resident. You know, I think that if somebody wants to, again, we're not trying to limit the ability for property owners to do compatible type of work with their properties. But I think that going from single-family to multi, two-family and multi-family is not, would not be appropriate. And I would personally recommend limiting a...
Well, we don't need to limit anything if we, B1 provides a limitation for the extension of the non-conforming use to single-family residents. B1 district regulations control unless there's a conflict, so we could just leave it as it is. We could take out this language completely and not need to add anything if the consensus of the commission agrees.
So, you know, my recommendation is to take out the sentence starting with "in this regard."
Exactly.
That would be my recommendation.
Do we have a consensus on that?
I agree with that.
Actually, no.
I'm trying.
I'm having a little problem with that because I thought that what we were trying to regulate or guide is the exterior appearance of the building. So whether it's a one-family, two-family, or four-family, if the exterior is in compliance, then why are we regulating how it's used?
Well, the policy debate is whether a two-family and a three and a multi-family residential dwelling unit is consistent and harmonious with the rest of the neighborhood. That's the policy debate that you all...
Is that not already controlled by the fact that it's in a B1 district and the B1 district will only allow a replacement of a residence and not a single-family residence?
That's my point.
John, is that true? If somebody has a single-family resident right now, they can only replace it with a single-family resident. Is that
correct? It's in our supplemental district regulations, but yes, if you have a non-conforming use such as a single-family residential home, you can replace that same house as long as it conforms to RA1A guidelines. So you can tear down a 1,000-square-foot house and build a 3,000-square-foot house.
But it's still a single-family house. Doesn't the RA1 guidelines, you're more familiar with this, but doesn't that allow duplex also?
It does not.
It doesn't, okay.
Yeah, this is already covered in the B1 district.
So actually, by putting this in there, we're extending what is already allowed. We're allowing...
If you want to keep it to single-family residence, you delete the sentence you talked about in B1 regulations, which are still operative, controls the issue.
But then a couple of people say that, well, we're interested in just the exterior design and not this. So this is a good, I mean, this is a debate then.
I think it's irrelevant because the B1 district already controls that. So we're only looking at the design, not the use. The use is already covered in the B1 district guidelines.
I would agree with this.
I agree.
Okay. Do we need to take a vote on this, or? Kathleen, you're down there. I can't see you.
I'm good.
You're good, okay. I just want to make sure, because that is a good point. All right, so I think the consensus is to take out the in regard and just let the B1 district guidelines, not guidelines, but the ordinance.
Did you have another point?
Yes. One other point. The other point was more of a question. It's kind of a use question, but it's not really a use question. You know, we talk about a business, and again, coming back to John's reference of business, what I'm concerned about is somebody coming in and taking a residential thing, knocking it down, putting up a single-family home that has 23 bedrooms in it.
Did you see my email from...
I did, but I just want to make sure it's clear in public here.
You're concerned about...
them calling themselves and then putting it on one of these things, and then them calling that process a business, that represents a business and not a residential unit because it's rented out on a weekly basis.
As I mentioned in a previous discussion, I'd have to go back and double-check it, but it was part of an argument I made, which resulted in a judgment invalidating the City of Wilmington's then-current short-term rental regulations. I didn't have time to look at it, but I can see the case in my mind. I'm 95% certain that the North Carolina Court of Appeals has ruled that the business of renting out space in residential use does not make that use commercial, that remains residential. So if that use remains residential, let's say short-term rental, in other words, what I'm saying is the courts in this state consider short-term rentals to be a residential use, not a commercial use. Therefore, if because residential use in B1 is non-conforming, any attempt to knock out a non-conforming residential structure and extend its use to that commercial activity devoted entirely to that, I think would result. I don't think that's possible.
Okay. The other option. Well, we'll come back to that. But the other option, which I think is possibly even more serious, is somebody knocking down, let's say, a hotel or a motel here that's a residential, but then that's a commercial activity, and replacing it with a big, massive house, which technically wouldn't be allowed unless they could prove that that represented a business. But what you're saying to me is they can't argue that that's a business because it's a weekly rental, and it was built as an intention of being a weekly rental, even though it looks like a house, it's still a business based upon your understanding. And that would not be allowed.
I didn't follow that. I'm saying two things. If somebody has a residence and they're doing short-term rentals, that use remains residential, notwithstanding the short-term rentals. It doesn't become commercial. Therefore, if an entity wanted to come in and first of all, they couldn't build a residential structure, even if they called it a residential structure, because it's not conforming. It's illegal. It doesn't exist. It comes down to this. If somebody comes up to John and says, look, I want to knock down that cottage. I want to build something with more square footage, and I'm going to rent it out as a short-term rental. John's going to say, sorry, you can't build that residential unit because the one that's there now is non-conforming, and what you're doing is extending the use. If you extend it to the whatever that district was, R1A1, whatever it is, that's fine. But if you're going to turn that into a commercial activity, that won't work because the courts have held that the rental of residential space is still a residential use.
Yeah. Again, I don't mean to harp on this, but that seems to make an argument that they could knock down because let's say there was a cottage there. That cottage could be rented out right now on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no regulations about that. If they were to knock that down, by your definition, and they build a big house, it's still a residential house. It's still non-conforming, but by your definition, it is not a business. So that seems to me that would be allowed.
What I disagree. I think there's lots of ways to kill a non-conforming use.
Okay.
I don't think I'm limited to the extension issue that we've been talking about.
What I'm concerned about, which is one of the issues that was raised maybe a year ago by a couple of the council members, is somebody coming in and knocking down a hotel and putting up some large, big houses for weekly rentals. Now that wouldn't be allowed because that's a non-conforming use if it's considered a residential house.
Well, you need to look at the definition of residence. Residence shall mean a dwelling unit used for long-term occupancy.
Okay. that's exactly the point then. That's exactly the point. If somebody comes in and makes an argument that I'm going to rent this on Airbnb for weekly rentals, can't I argue that that is no longer a residence, but rather a business, and therefore I can knock down a hotel and put up a big house and call that business? And that's exactly the point. I mean, you see what I'm saying?
Let's take a practical demo. The Apple, whoever owns it, or they...
I'm not that familiar.
Okay, but we all are. And wants to tear down John. Wants to tear down the Apple.
Well, who is long-term occupying that residence?
This is a hotel.
Now, let's say we're going to knock down a hotel and put a mega house up.
So they have to get a permit for that, and they have to get a COA, since it's in the historical area, correct? If somebody wanted to tear down the Admiral Hotel.
By this occupant, they would have to get a COA, yes.
Right, and we just said the COA, we would not, if I heard right, you can still, COA will not, you can still demolish it.
By this document, it would also require a different COA for the reconstruction.
Right, but let's say they went and did, wanted to put up those, like those houses on the corner of L and Land, but they were going to connect them together and say that's another hotel.
So the definition of tourist lodgings and square footages and whether or not they have cooking facilities and things like that, that would all apply.
Okay, so that would enter into that. So when they came for the COA for that, so no, you're
actually... There is a difference between hotels and tourist lodges.
Right, you're actually building townhomes. You're not building, you're not replacing with a hotel. And that's what the COA process would do when they were trying to come in for approval for that.
No, the COA process is all about the architectural, how it looks, right, how it feels.
This would be more under the existing B1 because you're taking a conforming business, which is a hotel. So that's a conforming use. Okay, and replacing it with a, let's say, what would normally be seen as a non-conforming, that wouldn't be allowed right now, regardless of whether we had the COA process or not.
You've really just answered the question. This is a B1.
This is a
B1,
right.
Decision, which is a planning and zoning issue, not an HBC design issue.
Yes and no, because we could put definitions into this document that would. But I'm concerned about that because that was one of the driving forces.
Can you articulate clearly what your concern is?
Okay, my concern is that in the B1 district right now, you have conforming activities such as a hotel. That's a conforming activity.
Right.
If somebody were to come in and say, I want to buy a hotel here, knock it down and put up a series of condos, okay, or maybe just one big house, okay, that would not be allowed under the current B1 because that would technically be a non-conforming.
Non-conforming residential.
Residential. Okay. What we're arguing is that your definition that you just read me of a residential has long-term occupancy as part of that definition. If I were to do this with the intent of making all those units Airbnb short-term rentals, couldn't I argue that that is in fact conforming because it is not residential as per our definition?
Well, let's assume for the sake of discussion it is. What's your issue?
We don't want that. We'd rather have hotels or other business activities. That I don't see a big house that's Airbnb short-term rentals as being a business and conforming to the B1 district.
Well, then I think the issue is to take a position that the proposed use that you hypothetically presented is residential based on that appellate court decision that says short-term rentals are residential use.
That's fine. I just want to make sure that everybody's clear that was one of the motivating issues, certainly not the only motivating, but one of the motivating issues for us looking at this whole issue here. Okay. All right, those are two comments I have. Any commissioners have comments regarding design guidelines or processes before we open it up to Mr. Eldridge? Kathleen, do you have anything?
Well, I don't know if I want to bring it up, but yeah, since you asked, John, I don't know how you feel about all of this. Somebody having some for the non-minor work. And this work is so non-minor, I mean, not quick, what am I saying? It's the, for the minor work, for these exceptions, for the minor work, like replacing caulking, and we got somebody that's living on 3rd Avenue South, and they've got a little house there, and their caulking went bad, and they want to replace it. Are we going to expect them to have to come in to ask John for permission, and John have to grant it and go through all that paperwork for something so minor? I think some of these just...
Does that caulking present a proposed change to an exterior feature?
Yes, it does.
In what way?
Well, the appearance, you have old caulking or cracked caulking, and then new caulking, but what I'm saying is that something that we want to... You know, John has enough work to do.
I don't know that new caulking represents a change in an exterior feature within the spirit of the ordinance.
Well, I think you have it here on...
Yeah, you actually have it as one of... You know, I think...
That's why I used it as an example.
No, I agree, because...
I think there are some things in here that it's a little bit overkill for me, I think.
So you're suggesting that there's some of these things that have been classified as minor work, we should just get put into a lower category where people can just do it?
Do it, right.
Yeah, I guess.
I think the example is a little confusing, because people are, you know, the comment came earlier about getting wrapped around the axle of... some of the intent we have here is examples. They think it's policy or the procedures that we're recommending.
I don't have any problem, and actually would recommend, to the extent that we can, streamlining these design standards. And so this discussion is good for that purpose. Rather than try to tinker with the definition of what constitutes minor work, why don't we look at this list of examples and take out things that really don't amount to that? I agree with Ms. Zielinski that 3.2C, caulking and weather stripping, I don't think that does really result in a change to an exterior feature. We can take that out. If you want to go through this list and take out some other things that you think...
Try to make it as simple as possible for John and make it as easy. You know, I agree. I mean, if I'm going to caulk, my goodness, would I want to have ply to be able to put window stripping around my window?
So let's take that out. Yeah. How about replacement of window glass? It doesn't sound like you're replacing windows. You're just replacing the glass.
I say take that out. I don't know how you feel.
I would say it's almost just the same style.
Let's go to...
Or you could say replacement of window glass unless it is a different style, and that would be minor work. Or just take out window glass completely.
Because if you change the style, you take out just a picture window and you put one with 15 different grids in it, that's changing the appearance.
Well, that's changing the window, that's not replacing the glass.
Well, double pane window with the interior grids, you're just replacing one big...
How about put replacement of window glass with a similar design?
You're trying to take it out of line. Yeah.
I think we just take it out.
All right, that's fine. If that's a consensus, sure.
Because changing the window would be a change to an exterior feature.
Now, I know that you put in the pruning. I don't think that was in my, as an example. I mean, I assume you got this from something.
Yeah, I worked with, play on words, Hickory had a very good set of historic district materials, and I wondered about pruning. It doesn't seem appropriate to me for the purposes of this list.
Yeah, I would take out pruning.
How about F? You want a COA for the removal? I'm not familiar with your tree preservation regulations, if any, but I do see where a big healthy tree that adds to the aesthetic, you might want to consider, you know, there's two sides of this coin. A tree is not an exterior feature, but trees do lend themselves to the look and feel of the neighborhood. So.
And all the design guidelines that I looked at had pruning and trees as part of the design guidelines too.
Well, we're going to take out pruning and leave the tree removal as is.
I think people should look seriously at whether taking out a tree disturbs the historic. I can't think of any trees that would classify like that, but.
Yeah, you may not have any. Take out E and leave F?
Is that okay to take out E?
Yeah.
How about F?
Well, I think we should remove the dead and diseased trees are responsible for that, but.
Keep the rest of it?
Well, you say, yeah, you know, after like a COA is required removal of a healthy tree with a trunk larger than 4 inches.
We're gonna take out E and we'll take out the first sentence of F.
Well, then, the second sentence, that's referring to non-minor work, right? Because it needs a COA?
Because it needs COA, yeah.
So it shouldn't be in, it, should it even be in the minor work section?
That's a good point.
I mean, I don't think a COA would be required to take out a small tree, but I think maybe John should look at it.
I want to think about after a storm or something like that, where we've had an emergency situation and there's trees and damage and stuff all over the place. You're not going to want to have to submit something to be able to clean up.
Don't worry, we're not going to be worried about that.
Yeah.
So, do you have a question?
Do you have tree removal provisions in the code?
There are. Basically, you have to get a $25 permit to put your tree down on your property.
And the language here is they want a COA for trees with a DBH of 12.7. Do we regulate that somehow, somewhere in the code?
There are trunk circumference dimensions referenced in the code, but I don't.
Tree preservation and protection is already provided to one degree or another in the code.
Kind of.
Why don't we just take it out?
I agree. Okay.
Thanks,
so the consensus is to do that.
Given what Mr. Benson said, I agree with that.
I personally think G and A should stay in there as minor.
How about I?
I think I should stay in there. I mean, so, what do you think?
Ditto for J.
So with these steps here, what are we asking the homeowner or the property owner to go to John and say, John, I'm fixing my driveway and I'm gonna, you know, some bricks came out of it, so I'm gonna put similar bricks in. Is that okay? Is that what we're trying to ask these people to do, and then have John have to say, yeah, it's okay?
Otherwise, how would you control minor changes to exterior features, which could defeat the whole purpose?
I know.
Yeah, the answer
is
yes. That's
why I'm having a little trouble with all of this.
I think you have to for that control, or it's checks and balances, isn't it?
And again, we can make it relatively simple. Is that, you know, I come to John saying, I want to repair my, you know, my driveway with, you know, 10 bricks, and he says, fine.
Yeah.
He signs off on it. I don't see it as a big problem.
The real burden is putting it in writing, but I don't think a minor situation like that's going to require a lot of writing.
And what something, a thought that just popped into my mind, though, is John the only one that would be able to, like, instead of saying, submitting the request to the building inspector, how about submitting it to the HBC?
Like, well,
I only meet once a month, and building inspectors can sign off on it in 5 minutes, right? So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think administrative approval, which is the term used in the statutes, contemplates staff action, not a public body action.
Of course, it helps that John's not the only one in inspections now either, right? So.
We got a ways to go, so can we finish looking at the list?
Yeah, but I think that's a good point, is that a lot of these seem pretty trivial, where, I mean, maybe we should just allow a lot of these things, and, you know, maybe only have a few things that would be administratively approved, and then really concentrate on the COA process.
Yeah, but how do you control compliance?
Well,
I've made it pretty simple by somebody saying, look, I want to do this, it's minor, here's my letter stating. vacating it, he writes a letter back saying thumbs up or thumbs down. That's pretty basic, that's pretty minimum. If you don't have that, and somebody's replacing their driveway, instead of using replacement materials, they make a really nice little graphic design out of contrasting bricks, how do you control that?
I think this has to be here.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It's not overly cumbersome, especially the one-page form, I heard somebody discuss earlier, that could just be as simple as a check and balance that, okay, this is a logical thing. It can be signed off in a few minutes by zoning inspection department or some other staff, and you move on, but at least there's a checkpoint.
Under the regulations, if John or the building inspection department doesn't feel like it amounts to minor work, then they have, it's referred back to you guys.
Okay. So anyway, we would take out B, C, E, part of F.
I thought we were gonna take out all of this.
All of F, and then leave, sounds like there's a consensus for control reasons to leave in G through.
N should move out since you're requiring it, the COA amendment. That's not mine.
Okay, you leave G through M?
Yeah.
Take out N?
Yes.
Take out N.
Back to L, the erection of a medium roof, that sounds non-minor.
Medium to dark, I think that's a reference to the color.
Oh, but I'm referring to the word, if, when you erect a roof, isn't that non-minor work?
Yeah, let's take out or erection.
Alteration and or restoration?
Right.
Okay.
What did we say about D, I missed that, at the top of the page?
I think we were gonna leave D in, I don't think anybody suggested.
So what about O through R on the top of the next page?
I think those are okay.
Yeah, I'm fine with those. Is there consensus to leave in O through R as minor?
I agree with leaving those in again, I believe this is a checks and balances type thing, it's not to make it complicated, but to allow you to catch the things that are not minor, that we've snuck through as
That's, yeah, that's.
Chairman, would it be appropriate to mention the concept of a joint workshop at this point?
Let's work through this first, if that's okay. And then we'll talk about the joint workshop, because I think the joint workshop would be more appropriate once we've cleaned up and have our recommended.
Right, I just want to make guidelines. I just want to make it clear that this is not the final word.
No. The issue about a joint workshop is that the council has expressed an interest in having a joint workshop on these issues. So my recommendation is that we don't vote on the design guidelines tonight, but we clean them up to the point that we would normally vote on, and then we have this joint workshop with the council. And then we would technically vote on during our February. I mean, that would be my recommendation, but it's again the commission's decision.
I think that's something council is interested in.
Can we have the joint workshop in time to be able to vote on it in the February?
It's a special meeting, 48 hours notice.
The mayor mentioned, and I believe Joseph mentioned, late January for a joint workshop.
Okay.
On this, but to go into the joint workshop, I'd like to have us feel comfortable with what we're presenting at the joint workshop.
It's my understanding that you're going to instruct me to make certain changes at the end of this meeting, and we'll have that document therefore cleaned up in that way for the joint workshop, and likewise, but to a much lesser extent because of the statutory authority, the zoning regulations that we'll look at.
And we've had a public hearing now, so based upon the public hearing, okay, not calling it a public hearing, but public input, that, you know, other than John's, which we'll go through John's recommendations and comments, we only had one person call in.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Any other comments on this before we get to the talking points?
Nope.
Good.
I think we're at the talking points.
Again, I'm going to basically read from the left-hand column. I'll point page four, you can see it over there on the right. John's comment is that, Andy, can we scroll up on the left-hand column to get to that comment? A little further up. Keep going. Keep going.
Yeah, you have to get to the...
Keep going. There you go. Mr. Batson wonders whether the process of amending the design standards should be handled as a text amendment with town council making final decision. My comment is by statute, HPC adopts the design standards. Council doesn't have that role. Council's not authorized to fulfill that role. But I know, based on the 7 years I've already been with the town, that I'm sure HPC would incorporate any input from council with respect to amending the design standards. Again, we're not talking about the build, the zoning regulations. Certainly, council would be responsible for acting on those amendments. But under statute, only HPC is the one adopting the amendments.
And I should point out that's exactly why we need to have a joint workshop, too, because that'll get the input from the council.
All right, Manny, can we go to page five, the next set of students? There you go. Actually, you want to go down a little bit on page five.
Yeah, we've already struck the pruning comment.
There we go. I don't know where that sticky is, but John raises the point about the list that we just walked through. It seems to be extremely restrictive. Property owners should not have to seek for general maintenance. I think we've kind of addressed that in our discussion. And again, when we get to the regulations, maintenance or repair that does not result in any changes to exterior features is not regulated by any. So I think John's comment about 3.2 has been met. So Mandy, can we go to page six, please? There you go.
I do think this was a good comment. The replacement's acceptable if they're identical or very similar. That need to go through a COA, because we've discussed the removal being minor and being a checkpoint.
Well, my response is right below that, right here. Again, is administrative approval only, and I think administrative approval is needed in order to ensure that the replacement materials are identical or acceptable. We just had this discussion. We need some sort of control. So I think what we're trying to avoid, to John's comment about are replacements acceptable if they're identical or very similar, or would you need to go through COA? They are acceptable for administrative approval purposes. You don't need to get a COA if you're going to do some minor work that results in the replacement of materials that are identical or similar. But in order to monitor the changes on the exterior features, I do think that administrative approval is the way to go.
That makes sense.
Down at the bottom, Mandy, let's scroll down a little bit. It looks like we might have some overlap on the comment there. All right, maybe scroll down. There you go. Thank you. And if you could go over to the left-hand column and scroll down so we can keep going.
A little bit more.
And a little bit more. Thank you. I think maybe you might just have not.
I think so
far.
Too. Okay.
John raises the question, what exactly is a 1940-1970 building look? This should be described or demonstrated with a picture. My response is see the designation report, which has an architectural narrative. It also provides a statement of the significant historical and cultural features. It also contains an inventory of property labeled as contributing to the district and non-contributing. But at the end of the day, as I tried to stress during the special meeting, it basically comes down to three things. Avoiding expressionist and abstract exterior features, which is fine in the standards. The proposed changes meet the design standards and the review criteria set forth in the zoning regulations. And most importantly, are the proposed changes consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood? And again, council handles consistency and harmony for special use permit purposes without a description or a depiction. Council simply makes that determination based on the proposed use and the materials that support that application. In this instance, HPC has got some guidelines that will help it make that determination. Those guidelines are found in the articulation of the significance of the district in the designation report, the design standards that we're working through right now, and the review criteria, which is a separate provision in the zoning regulations that we'll look at the next meeting.
This, I should say that this is probably one of the most difficult things to put in there, because when talking about this now for about 6 months, a lot of people would say what they don't want to have in the district. But it's very difficult to look at something like Curie Beach and say, what are the elements that makes Curie Beach look like it's Curie Beach? And when we look at the designation report and the architectural narrative, and I think when you look at the inventory of what we have in Curie Beach, it's that 1940s to 1970s kind of overall feel, family feel. So that's why we have 1940s to 1970s. I think we've got to be careful about the language to say that it doesn't have to look exactly like a 1940s and 1970s, but it should be considered in terms of, and that's why the word should, I mean, if you can find a better word than should, but it should be considered that that is kind of the architectural theme that creates Curie Beach look and feel and ambiance as it is today, as that 1940s to 1970s beach community.
I agree, and again, one of the purposes that has guided us, and which is expressed clearly in the zoning regulations that we'll look at with PZC, we are not imposing any architectural style, we are not dictating any restrictions on use. We are simply setting forth legal instruments to control any changes to exterior features in the B1 neighborhood so that they are consistent and harmonious with what you've got there right now.
So I have a procedural type question, and this will tie directly in with, you know, some of the Mr. Benson's activities on the minor changes and minor things. And I think it kind of answers this, or will answer this as to what the look and aesthetics like as well. But let's say somebody brings something that is technically minor to John and or the building inspection department, and John or whomever is uncomfortable with, does that fit? Right? It's not a slam dunk, rubber stamp, off you go type thing. At that point, he simply says no, and it has to come to HPC under for a COA. That
John can refer the matter to HPC for a COA, but he also has the ability, not necessarily John, the building inspector can deny the administrative approval, and that administrative approval can be appealed to the HPC within 10 days, so it ends up being the same thing, whether the applicant does it or whether the building inspector refers it.
That's what I'm trying to get to, is that we're not trying to put the whole balance of this on the building inspection department. They can say, no, I'm not comfortable with that requirement. request, and then it get forwarded or denied and moved up to the HVC.
We're trying to keep this as easy as possible for everybody.
Right. Yeah, but I'm not relying on, not that I wouldn't, but I'm not relying on John to be the deciding factor. He can say, I'm not sure about that, I don't like that, or I'm not comfortable with it, and that denies it and moves it forward. So.
I mean, it could be both an interpretation of the guidelines or whether it's a major or minor issue. Might consider saying, you know, this really is kind of a major issue, therefore it needs to go to HVC.
Right. So I think that answers some of that in that you don't really have to overly document what those aesthetics are. If the building inspection department's like, I'm not sure if that fits, that's it right there. Then it comes to HVC and goes to the...
And, you know, and that is always the problem with this too, because again, when you look at a lot of historic districts, including the downtown historic district in Wilmington, now their other districts aren't as detailed, literally the guidelines or the, whatever you want to call them, the standards are 100 pages long. They go into exactly the type of materials, and I mean, they're very, very, very complex. You know, whenever we recommend an ordinance, whether it was a lighting ordinance or any type of ordinance, I think the strong interest on the part of the town council, the community, as well as the commission here, is that we try to keep it as simple and understandable as possible. Now, the downside of that is that when you have a two-page set of guidelines, obviously it's going to create the opportunity for more interpretation rather than 70 pages of guidelines. But I think that's the... It's cost-benefit, and I believe the cost of doing a 70-page detail far exceeds the benefit given the nature of Kira Beach. And I think the downside here is, well, it's a little interpretive, but I think the benefit of keeping the flexibility is the key thing here.
Yeah, I don't see having some interpretation here as a downside, because part of the character and nature of the Kira Beach downtown district is that it's varied and is that there is diversity.
And that's one of the things that when we talk to the architect about creating an architectural narrative, you know, I've grown up in beach communities both on the West Coast and the East Coast pretty much all my life. And one of the first things that strikes you about a beach community, whether on the West Coast or East Coast, is that it is diverse. I mean, it's the diversity to some extent. And that's why we're struggling to say, well, what? I mean, what can you define a beach community? And part of that is the diversity. So we ask, you know, we're building that into the guidelines here.
And part of that diversity is the result of hurricanes, of course. I mean,
yeah.
You've got salt there. You've got a lot of property conditions that are a result of its location on the coast.
And due to the 1960s and 70s hippie era, you know, that like diversity in beach communities. I mean, a lot of folks like that moved to the beach communities.
It was a good time to be alive. John's final comment at the bottom of the five is with respect to the limitation of using predominantly glass elements, glossy material, brown windows, exposed steel elements. John logically asked whether this restricts development, property values dictate maximizing potential. In most cases, this equates to positioning for ocean views, which means glass goes into the design of the structure. That's a valuation question, and therefore, I can't answer that. And it really ends up being a policy consideration for you all. I did wonder whether there was any empirical evidence that supports the proposition that maintaining the look and feel of the B1 neighborhood will impede development. Although I've not looked at them, I recall the chairman generally referring to the empirical studies that suggest that the establishment of the preservation historic zone actually promotes property development and investment.
Yeah, there's actually a fair number of studies. Needless to say, people researched everything. And so I'll just go ahead. I did present this to the town council. This is the most recent comprehensive study that I could find. It was published in 2014. I believe I actually sent that several months ago to the commission here. And it's titled Historic District Influence on House Prices and Marketing Duration, Journal of Real Estate, Finance and Economics. And just for the record, this is volume 48, 2014, pages 112 and 131. And I just have two quotes here. It's a fairly mathematical, but a very good empirical study. And it's the only study that looked not only at valuations within the district, but also valuations for the surrounding community. And here on the summary, the front end of this article says, most of the existing literature focuses on the extent to which a historic district designation is capitalized into values inside the historic district. Individual property owners that pay a price premium reap the benefits of the prestige, government commitment, higher rates of appreciation, and reduced uncertainty about neighborhood preservation associated with the historic designation. So that's looking at all the prior studies. And then in the result of their empirical study, it says, our results support the established notion in urban economics literature that historic preservation generally has a positive impact on property values within a historic district, and in particular that a historic designation is associated with average property values increase of over 5% in the mean value. Not only that, but we find that the designation of a neighborhood as historic has positive spillover effects for nearby properties. Our findings imply that historic preservation efforts do result in positive externalities for both properties inside and outside the historic boundaries. And again, I teach the course at UNCW on valuation, so this is actually my specialization. And there's a number of theoretical and empirical reasons why this is the case. So all the evidence points to historic designation increasing property values for a number of different reasons. And that's what the empirical evidence shows.
But the way I understand John's comment, he's just referring to restricting predominant glass elements. And this being a beach town and people wanting to view the ocean, that might...
What that was written there for, and I have to admit, I put that in there as trying to define a way that we just don't have something like the glass house that we've already referred to in the historic district, which is predominant glass.
Well, that's completely glass.
Well, yeah, but...
Maybe change predominant to complete.
Well, it's not completely. I mean, there are other elements. And a good example, and Joseph, I think, points this out. I don't know how many people have seen the new building that's in Carolina Beach, that there's two restaurants on the bottom, and then I think there's two or three floors above that.
Yeah.
It's a very nice building. It's a very, very nice building, but would we want to have that in downtown Carolina Beach? It would destroy immediately the ambiance. I mean, it's a great building, but at the right place. And so that is not 100% glass, but it is certainly predominantly glass.
Chairman, I don't intend to speak for John or have his comments speak for him as well. John, if John wants to jump in, I hope that he will do so. And add any comments. I mean, they're his comments that we're talking about.
John, do you want to say anything?
No, I've said what I've said. Okay. It seemed like it was very well received when I said it, so I don't have anything else to say about this.
Well, I do think that in some cases that the building code is going to take over what we do or what the owner would do to the facility or to their house. They may require us to do certain things. Or there's numerous different things to the roof or to the doors. Maybe it's too small a door, who knows? But there could be some things that come up that change the look of the house that we have to be aware of. And I think I understand what John's trying to get at. In some cases, they have little tiny windows, and maybe for egress or certain access or certain things that the building code requires for that building or house, it may change it. That's something we have to be aware of.
I think
that. And that's going to supersede whatever, you know, we write here, because we can't go, they can't fix their house, and, you know, we're going to be restrictive of what we tell them to do.
Right, but I don't think this really limits having a large enough window for egress or having a number of windows. I think this really is a way for, during the COA process, to stop the all glass, right? So if somebody wants five large windows on the front of their house and it fits with the style of the house, then that's not a problem.
But is that predominantly glass? I mean, I think it's the interpretation of what is being written up there that I think if we keep into as close to as we can with the original intent, you know, it fits in, maybe they have, I don't know, whatever they have to put there, but it's not all glass, but it's going to be different, but it's going to meet the building codes, it's going to meet certain standards that they're going to be happy with.
But I think that's fine the way it is, because it's going to ultimately come in front of the HPC for review, and having some large windows or something else, as long as it's not the only feature, is probably going to go through HPC and okay, so it's not...
It's a case-by-case situation.
And remember, these are guidelines.
Right.
And so it's up to the HPC during the COA process to interpret, to look and see if it's compatible. I personally can't see how, you know, that building in Carolina Beach that we're talking about, yeah, I would call that predominantly glass. It's not 100% glass, but it's predominantly glass. That's good. As nice as it looks, I can't see that fitting here. It's not compatible. So, I mean, these are guidelines, not necessarily absolutes.
Well, the height restrictions keep that away, so.
No, the height, you know, certainly not the design.
But if you had a large window or sliding door or whatever facing towards the ocean for a residential part of something that's on the second floor, however it fit, that's not necessarily out of character, right? So that could be allowed. It's just if you've got that whole wraparound glass look. I think this comes back to the COA process and the HPC and being able to do things on a case-by-case basis that fit and meet the style and intent of this document. I think you're picking a word apart too much.
I think I was reading it the same way John was. It was being restrictive to the owners or whoever was doing the...
Well, there is some restriction to the owners, but actually that restriction creates value. Okay, it reduces the uncertainty. No, it's. I mean, without getting into a lecture on value, value is going to be based upon the reduction of risk associated with investment. Okay, by having restrictions such as what we're talking about, that's exactly what all the empirical studies are about. When you have restrictions, you reduce the risk of a neighbor saying, well, I want to have something stored or something like that, and all of a sudden, you know, some other neighbor goes and builds this big glassy house, which then hurts your particular property. So, I mean, this is classic valuation economics, where by creating restrictions that reduce the negative externalities, and they even reduce the externalities, the impact on a neighbor creates value for the whole community. And that's, again, why we have zoning rule, because
I understand.
I can't see how, at least in this situation, restricting a predominantly glass building decreases the value of the community.
I didn't say anything about decreasing value. I just said the way that I read it was similar to what John was saying. It seemed like it was being restrictive to what the, you know, because it, regardless of what we're going to put in there, building codes and other ordinances may take precedent of whatever's put here.
I agree with that. I mean,
when I read that, I said, well, that creates a lot of more concern for the property owner that are going to have to work around certain things that are very restrictive.
I'm going to interject something. I don't think we're dealing with restrictions at all. I think we're dealing with guidelines to help the applicant, John for minor work, and the HPC for major work to determine if the proposed changes to the exterior features are consistent and harmonious with the look and feel of the neighborhood. If you read that paragraph correctly, the general standard is the changes to any exterior portion should have the look and aesthetic of the B1 neighborhood, should avoid modern or expressionistic design. Inappropriate modernistic or expressionistic architectural design includes predominant glass elements. It's not saying you can't have predominant glass elements. You can, if the finished product is consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood. It is saying you can't have expressionistic or abstract architectural details, including predominant glass features like the old glass house on Fort Fisher Boulevard. So, in the interest of time, shall we move on to the next comment? Page 6. difficult bouncing back. It's not like comments on a Word doc. It's hard. It's harder with Adobe. I thought I had commented on John's. I'm sure I did. I just don't.
You did. They're there, but when I exposed them,
there I am.
They cover up.
My response to John's comment about what colors are appropriate for a beach community was that a rigid list of required colors invites controversy, dispute, and sometimes litigation. These standards avoid that by the simple underlying requirement that the colors be consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood and by avoiding franchise, striped, and banding paint schemes. You can close that comment, Mandy, please. And John's next comment, I think we've already discussed just prior there too. Down there, John's comment, are we using the description of the historic district to define the character?
I'm sorry, but can we go back to that one again about the windows? Because that one is restricted. The first one was a little bit more vague, but this is saying there shall be no large-scale windows or doors.
That's good.
I do agree with that. I do think that that one is a duplication. That whole point D is a duplication of what was said on the previous page in A.
How about if we just leave a no single architectural window and then just no single
architectural feature should dominate. Yeah, that's a good catch. Thank you.
I would be fine with that. Drop the highlighted portion and just start with no single architectural feature and exterior portion should dominate.
Yeah, the design features including windows and doors should be of normal scale, no single architectural feature.
I agree with that because the specific piece that John highlighted is already covered in A.
Okay. Mandy, did I comment on the John's comment that you've got already? I thought I did. This comment is, maybe I just kind of summed it up. Are we using the description of the historic district to define the character? This seems speculative to me. And my response, I think, to you're good. My response, I think, to both of those is right there. It comes down to any proposed changes being consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood. Council has had no problem applying the standard when considering rezonings and special use permits, one of the requirements of which is that proposed special use is consistent and harmonious with the surrounding neighborhood. I go on to say, indeed, council can make that determination without the additional guidelines and standards that HBC has the benefit of in determining COA.
And you know, again, to reaffirm that too, that is kind of the cost-benefit I referred to earlier. When you have a fairly simple, short, flexible set of guidelines, you end up probably having some debate. So I can certainly, just like the special use permit, where you can have five members debating whether it's compatible or not. But I think from the cost-benefit point of view of having simple, straightforward guidelines rather than 70 pages of detail, the benefit is much, much higher, even though I think everybody recognizes that the downside might be a little bit of discussion in terms of the interpretations.
At the bottom of the page, that's a typo that I've already addressed in the computer. Mandy, if we could go to the last page, which is page 7.
Is that bottom link, is fourth misspelled? Yeah, that should
that's
be.
That's what I was just talking about.
Yeah, so that fourth is misspelled.
I've corrected that. John's comment to 4-3 could be interpreted many ways. I want to build a brand new house surrounded by one-story cinder block houses and buildings. Does that mean I can only build a one-story? Why don't you open up my comment with your cursor? No such restrictions exist under the standards and the overlay district zoning regulations. The proposed structure needs simply be consistent and harmonious with the B1 neighborhood. So you're not restricted to only building a cinder block building if you tear one down. Whatever you're proposing simply needs to be consistent and harmonious. Can you close that comment, please, Mindy? My next comment is under 4-5. John's comment being the single statement restricts new development. Oh.
You have this, another one.
I had another one up there. Oh, there it is. Again.
Okay.
My point is consistent. I don't need to talk about 4.5. My recommendation is to simply delete 4.5 current text and replace it with a simple sentence that a COA application for relocation, demolition, or destruction shall not be denied. Again, that's pursuant to underlying general statute. It says the same thing.
Is that consensus to recommend that?
I agree with that. Yeah.
That finishes my comments, my presentation based on John's comments, which I do think cover a lot of potential issues and represent a good talking points to further our discussion.
And while it may have created a lot of back and forth, that's exactly what this needed. So thank you, John.
All right.
We need good, healthy discussion right over these things.
No, certainly. And this is the right form to do it right here, too. I mean, this is the purpose of why we're having meetings today. All right. Are there any other comments before we give guidance to Mr. Eldridge?
I did want to just say that I am concerned for some of the property owners that are in this district, like when you are 3rd Avenue South, and like people who have already, they're already living there, and they already own the home. They don't have the choice to say, oh, that's the historic district and there are these regulations. I choose not to purchase that home. They're already there. So I know they're grandfathered in with what they have right now, but I just want to make sure that we're considering our residents, the people that are going to be affected by this.
I agree, and that's why we've had open hearings and why we've had public hearings and things like that. At the very beginning, before you were involved, we did have a number of residents come. The primary concern was that we were not going to regulate the interior. Most of the residents, and we didn't have a lot, maybe had 4 or 5 show up at the very beginning of the process, and when they understood that we were not regulating their interior, they were fine with it. And I think I've actually owned properties in historic districts, and I know I have several friends who have properties in historic districts here in Wilmington, and I own a commercial building, a three-story commercial building in a historic district. There's no question that I invested more money because it was in a district than in properties that I owned outside that particular district, because it really does benefit, you know, the community. So I think for those residents that you're talking about, there's a little bit of a windfall by doing this, because we're actually allowing a lot of flexibility for them to utilize the property, as well as providing the mechanism for increasing the value associated with the property.
I missed some of the discussion. Are you referring to neighbors living around the perimeter of the district?
The ones within the district, the ones on the east side of 3rd Avenue South.
I'll simply point you. This might not be applicable to your point, but I think it's useful to know that for matters involving HPC determination for COA, notice goes out to the subject property, the applicant that is, and to any properties that are abutting the subject property, including properties directly across the street. So anytime major changes are proposed to an exterior feature within the district, the surrounding properties to that property, the abutting properties to that property, even including across the street, which would be in a different district the way you all have your districts drawn, will get notice of that hearing. And can therefore participate.
Unless there's any more comments, what I would recommend is that we have Mr. Eldridge make the changes that have been suggested by the commission, and try to have those relatively soon so we could schedule a joint workshop with town council that we could work through these things.
2 points, one minor, based on the question in the special meeting, okay with the commission if I add the boundary description that I just lifted out of the designation form and plugged into the statement?
I mean, that's fine with me.
I can put it in the press.
Based upon the comment of the...
How will we go about scheduling a joint workshop, an email to all the members?
I can send out a meeting poll and I can give like a range, I can list dates and times, and then everyone responds, and whatever the most popular vote is what the meeting would be. So, is there any specific dates that you guys are unavailable?
Sure.
I mean, then, for late January.
This isn't tied to the council meeting, right? We can do this before.
It would be a separate meeting.
Yeah, this will be a separate
meeting. Right, but it doesn't have to be before the next council meeting. It could be after.
No, it could. Yeah. Okay. Probably just need to have it prior to probably the 10th of February or something.
Yeah, well, let's think about that. If we did it before one of the things that could happen in the January 25th meeting, if we had to join a workshop before the 25th, one of the things that would normally come to council on the 25th, well, let me back up a minute.
This will push everything back a month.
Yeah, because BCC is going to table its review.
We'll see how it goes. What this would do is push everything back a month, which is fine, I mean, in terms of trying to get a sense. I would anticipate that if the council listens to the recording of these meetings, that we probably have answered the majority, if not all, the questions that the council members might have.
I would hope so.
Maybe not all of them, but that possibly this meeting would not be that long, is what I would hope.
Yes,
you have a concerned look at that.
So you're saying February would be, you said push it off a month?
No, it would push our votes to the February meeting.
Because
we'd have to have a workshop with the council in late January, and assuming that went well and there's not a lot of changes, then what we could do is then we could vote as the HPC in our February meeting to pass this on to council. And then the P&Z could vote on the text amendments to pass on the council to their February council meeting. They would then have to set up a public hearing, which would be in March, and then they would vote in March. So it basically pushes our original schedule back 1 month, which I think is perfectly fine to get some consensus, obviously, with this.
I'll throw out the 20th.
The 20th of January?
Yeah.
Is that what day of the week is that?
That's Wednesday.
It's a Wednesday.
I will not be here.
I was looking at Wednesday, Thursday, the 27th, and the 28th.
The 27th would work well for me if that's an option for everyone else.
Yeah, I can do that.
Our council meeting's on the 25th.
Right.
So Wednesday, the 27th would work. What about Thursday? I need to give them dates. I mean,
I'm pretty flexible.
I have council members that have full-time jobs also.
I'm teaching online right now rather than any night classes, so I'm fine.
Wednesday 27, Thursday 28 works for me.
Are these evenings or during the day?
Whatever. What do you think is best?
I can do evenings or day.
Yeah.
Me too.
I'm going to be limited on the 28th. That it would have to be pretty late in the day or evening, but the 27th could be at any time.
Okay. So 27th, any time.
I think the evening is what we normally do, 5:30 or 6.
Yeah, but I don't mind the idea of an afternoon meeting. That way you guys don't
I'll put the time out there and everybody can. So I don't know if you've ever done a meeting poll before, but if you're available for all of it, you put you're available for all of it. You just go down and click available, yes, 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 or no, 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 however they got it set up. So you include all of your availability for those 2 days, right. Not just your favorite, you know what I mean, if
not
you're available.
Favorite.
Right, it's pretty simple, just press this little button.
So like when I send it out for the 28th, you can put when you're not available.
Yeah.
So this will be after the January. So what I would like to do is, again, come to the council meeting on January and give them, the council, an update. But by that time, we will have scheduled, hopefully.
I'll send out the meeting poll tomorrow.
Okay, all right, good. So we don't need to have a motion for this, do we? To direct the...
I don't think so, no, I wouldn't think I'd have a motion.
Is that a consensus that Mr. Eldridge, okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Any new business? Okay, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay, second? Second? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Do we need to take a break before it gets into PZ?
Please.
Okay.